This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today on Sticks In, I am home from D.C. and the PLL Championship Series, so we're going to talk about the entire event, some takeaways I had, some things that I loved about it, some things I'd maybe want to see change a little bit going forward, and then a day late, my apologies, but it's the Wednesday Top 20, not the Tuesday Top 20 this week. We're looking at the weekly media poll in Division 1. We'll look at who finished where and how I voted for it and the differences between my votes and the way things all shook out. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, please do leave a like, subscribe, a rating, 5 stars, download, whatever it is that your podcast platform of choice allows you to do. And let's do it. Welcome back to Sticks In. My name's Dan Arestia. I'm happy you're here. This episode, a day late. Usual cadence is Tuesday, Friday. It's going to be Wednesday, Friday this week. I apologize for that. On Monday, I was in Washington, D.C. for the PLL Championship Series final, humble brag, which was absolutely incredible. We got an OT thriller. But my journey home happened to be quite a long one. What is typically about a five-hour ride for me ended up being about 7 hours, thanks to a massive accident on 95 in Maryland. And then, oh, just the worst, like road work being done literally four exits away from my house. That added like another 30 minutes when I was so close to home. Just insult to injury kind of traffic. In that moment, I vowed to take Amtrak more often. We'll see. That might have just been one of those promises you make in a foxhole that you're never going to keep kind of thing. Anyway, the PLL Championship Series, the event itself, I would say, very much a success. Crowds were great. They were loud. They were engaged. The games were good. There were a couple, even like blowouts don't really feel like blowouts in sixes. So I don't know. Bar Down was packed, very much so on Saturday in particular. There were like 3 to 4 people deep in Bar Down watching the game. I got a chance to meet a lot of people and say hello to a lot of people who don't get to see in person that often, meet some new people, which I actually do enjoy despite being pretty socially awkward in real life. On the whole, a lot of things that I definitely loved. There are some things that I think maybe I would take a look at for next year as the PL iterates on this again. So I guess we'll just kind of go through my notes. I was just taking notes like throughout the week on things that I was loving as they happened, things where I was like, oh, maybe we should update this a little bit. So I'm just going to kind of expound on those for you. The first one, injuries suck. I wrote this kind of after pool play. I did a little, pool play takeaways on sticksandlacrosse.com. But at that point, we'd seen Garrett Eppel, Ricky Miaison, and Cole Williams all go down hurt. Eppel's hamstring injury really didn't seem major, but part of dealing with injuries in this tournament is that the whole event is like almost a week long, not even a week long. So any injury, even a minor injury, probably is just going to rule you out for the duration of the event. That's basically what happened with Eppel. Cole Williams' injury definitely looked a little bit more serious. He was on crutches the rest of the week without much weight at all on his left leg. So, I don't want to try and get into exactly what happened there because I don't have like an exact confirmation, but we'll kind of see. Hopefully he's able to come back, at some point soon, we'll see. But even since pool play ended, when I had wrote about those guys in particular, we saw Rob Pennell got hobbled a little bit. He was able to finish the event, but he's a little banged up. And then Matt Moore went down with a hip injury. And that's to say nothing of obviously the stuff that came in the final itself. More on that in a second. That's kind of its own topic. But those are just basically just like the non-contact injuries or the light contact injuries. And in the first year of this event, this really wasn't something we saw a lot of, at least like anecdotally off the top of my head. I was like, yeah, Kyle Bernlohr got hurt last year in like the early days of the event and got replaced by Brandon Krebs, which ended up being an awesome story. But otherwise, there really weren't a ton of like of big time injuries that I don't remember any. Maybe somebody can jog my memory on that, but certainly not as many as what it felt like this year, where it felt like every game somebody was going down. Somebody else was getting hurt. And for something like that, it's tough to figure out what the solution is. I had a little like back and forth with Hutton Jackson on Twitter and everything, because he was saying the PLL should consider moving away from the St. James for the event. And I agreed, maybe take a look at other venues that can support it, even maybe try and get bigger. And you can just say, hey, look, we outgrew the St. James. But that basically would be to say, look, the turf on the field here is a major part of the problem. These are all non-contact injuries. It's got to be something with this field, or at least that's at least a contributor to it, which is not a huge leap to take, considering how many injuries, like I said, were non-contact or very light contact. I feel like I would also suggest the PLL consider a 14-man roster for this, two goalies and 12 field players. Even if you do it like you do with the regular season where you only dress a certain number and you got the two extras in reserve or something. Player fatigue, player conditioning are a major part of this event, both times we've had it. And guys, by the end of it, are gassed. They are exhausted. I think an expanded roster helps with that. And if you have fresher guys, you have a fresher product. You have better play. I mean, just look at, you know, Tommy Palasek came in, number one, because he's an awesome player. But number two, he was also by far the freshest guy on the field. And he was able to just run by everybody. He's really, again, I'm not taking anything away from him as a player anyway, but like, if you show up after everybody else has already played four games, whatever it was, and your legs are fresh, like, you can see what these guys can do when they're feeling at 100%. And by the time you get to Saturday or Friday even, these guys are not even close to 100% anymore. So, you know, the expanded roster helps with that. It helps with the injury thing. The way it's currently structured is you have a 12-man roster, two goalies, 10 field players. And then there's a reserve player pool that's basically at any given time a goalie and two or three field players, something like that. When a team loses two players to injury, they can add one player from the reserve pool. So if you are at 12 and you go down to 11, you cannot add anybody until you go down to 10. And then you can add one player to get up to 11. And when you add somebody out of the player pool, there's somebody new who moves into the player pool in case more players are needed. And that happened a few times. It's kind of like hockey e-bugs, but for basically any position on the field in lacrosse. So again, we saw some really cool opportunities as a result. Kevin Winkoff shows up after getting a call at like 11 o'clock at night saying from Coach Bates, like, can you be here in the morning kind of thing. You know, we already said Tommy Palasek shows up for a playoff game after that Matt Moore injury, has 6 goals. It's a ton of fun for that reason. And it's a great opportunity for those guys. I still think the wider roster just lets those guys be there from the jump. And maybe they don't get a ton of burn in games where you don't think you're going to need them, but at least then they're there. And if you get into, you know, I hate describing it as it doesn't matter because it always matters to these guys. They're always competing to win, but everybody makes the playoffs. So the pool play games don't really matter a ton in the manner of speaking that the outcome isn't going to put you in or knock you out of the playoffs. So you know what? If it comes down to it on Saturday and you've got some guys who are stars who you know are going to play every minute of every game come playoff time, and you give them a blow and give those 13 and 14 guys longer reps and let them kind of do the work and showcase what they can do. A lot of this event is about guys getting an opportunity to showcase what they can do. We'll talk more about that in a second too, but you know, when you all that kind of comes together to me, it just seems like a good reason to consider the wider roster. I know it's not going to be what it's like in the Olympics, but we're already pretty different from the Olympics with this anyway. So unless, you know, the rules can obviously tweak in the next 4 years on both sides. The Olympics can change. The PLL can change. But, you know, it's just something I'd look at for the event when it's this strenuous and this condensed. Next note I made, the Unleashed game was probably the second most fun game of the weekend for me, maybe even the most fun game of the weekend for me, behind only the title game of the championship series. I was saying to people while I was there, and I wrote it a little bit, but I am very much a novice at women's lacrosse. I do not know scheme, X's and O's, strategy, anything like that. I am trying to learn, and I'm trying to watch more just because I love lacrosse, and I'm trying to appreciate the women's game more. But right now I tend to tune in to see the stars, the big names of the game play, because you can always just marvel at what somebody's able to do with athletic skill and ability on a lacrosse field. So I would always tune in for that. But in terms of like the strategy to get them where they were going or those kind of things, you can kind of see some of it, but I really don't understand a ton. And when I watch the women's game, like in the college game on TV, sometimes there feels crowded. Sometimes it feels like there's a ton of space. It feels like there's a ton of players, and I'm trying to follow it. And it's challenging for me as somebody who doesn't know it very well to just pick it up just by watching. But the exhibition game, the Unleashed game, all of that gets stripped right out. We're taking it right down to the basic. We are just going to get up and down and play and have fun. And, so like in a manner of speaking, when you think about what Sixes was built for, what the point of it is to take somebody who's never seen this game and get them to like it and make it easy and accessible and simple to understand. As you think about Sixes that way, I was the target audience for Sixes and this game because I don't know what I'm watching usually, but this made it seem easy to me. And I felt like someone new to the sport, interested in understanding it, looking for a reason to watch more of it. And I got it. Every single trip up and down in that game had highlights. Every single one. An exciting play. Just something cool happened every time up and down the field. When that game ended, I immediately wanted to just fire up the stream and watch it again in case I missed something, because Sixes can be like that too. It was joyful. There was incredible skill level. It was fun. Everybody who played it looked like they were having the time of their lives. It was everything I love about lacrosse. So Unleashed game, I would say they knocked out of the park. My next note, I think we need some kind of acknowledgement or award or something for the defensive end of the field in this thing. And I'm not just saying that because I have a bias, because I like defense. Because the Golden Stick is the award that's sort of like a de facto MVP kind of thing. It's given to the highest goal scorer in the tournament. Kieran McArdle won it this year, and he gave the award away to a fan in the stands, which was kind of met with some mixed reactions. I think there were some people probably around the league who didn't love that. There were some fans who thought it was like kind of funny and you know, all that kind of stuff. Obviously, there's also like the fact that it's just a nice gesture for that fan. But, you know, that is what it is. Romar Dennis won it last year. In both cases, these are guys who were on the team that lost in the finals and were very clearly not happy while receiving their award. It's hard to do. There's no good way or right way to make that, you know, feel great for the guy getting the award, for the audience, for anything. That aside, the players who stole the show in the final, and for a lot of games for me, were Matt DeLuca and Colin Kirst. DeLuca, if there was just a straight-up MVP of the tournament, he would have been a finalist for it. He could have even maybe been a winner. 65 saves in the tournament, including ones to literally keep the championship game alive from his knees on a doorstep shot from Marcus Holman. Like, it was unreal, the saves that were being made by Matt DeLuca. He had the best scores against among the players who were really regular starters, even with an extra game at, like, 17 scores against. And in Sixes, that number is, like, bonkers. You know, coaches talked about, from every team, coaches talked about how huge it can be to have a goalie steal one or two in the course of a game, if you can then turn that into a goal or even a two-pointer for yourself. DeLuca was doing that every single game, like multiple times a game, stealing shots, stealing balls that would go in on any other goalie that was there. I feel like some kind of acknowledgement for him, particularly because he's a guy who is usually in a backup role. He's usually backing up Dylan Ward. So with the opportunity he got, the way he rose to it, the way he stood out in the tournament, I think guys like DeLuca and Colin Kirst as well was the same caliber of goalie to me in this event. Something for the defensive side of the field, you know, would be great. I think guys like Christian Scarpello had a great tournament too. You watch the way he plays and the way that entire Waterdog short stick D mid group plays, really, And like the footwork and the angle play on display from Scarpello in particular was awesome, because you still have to be physical. You have to be able to push a guy off their dodge. But even if Scarpello was giving up a step somewhere, the way he played an angle to get back in front of his man, or to cut off a dodge, or turn his man back from where the goalie wanted him to go, I thought he had a really excellent week too. The next takeaway, all right, let's just do it. The hits, plural, singular, whatever, depending on which ones you want to talk about, I guess. But it's good. We'll go right to the obvious ones. As background here, the ones that I'm talking about, in case you're living under a rock in the lacrosse world and you aren't sure what I'm talking about. In the early moments of the championship series finals, Michael Sowers got hit as he took a shot, stayed down for a few minutes, was ultimately helped to the sideline, and then ruled out of the game. You know, he was always a little wobbly coming off the field. They never actually physically said this is what he has, but it you know, had all the familiar signs and signals of a concussion type of injury. Not long after that, Jack Trainer gets hit high late. He was able to remain in the game. The Sowers hit in particular has kind of become the subject of maybe a little bit of debate. The Trainer hit was the 2-minute non-releasable, clearly high, clearly late. Nobody, you know, except maybe Nick Acella, would say they're okay with that hit. The Sowers hit draws more debate since he basically got run over as he shot the ball. And, you know, he's contacted high. Did it start high? Did his head hit the ground? Did the player hit the head? You know, the replay kind of makes it clear that he takes some contact to the head. A lot of the question seems to be, or, you know, a lot of the discussion seems to kind of dance around this question of whose job it is to protect players, maybe. You know, if you're the guy getting hit, do you need to be smarter about what you're doing and try to avoid those kind of hits? If you're the person hitting somebody, is it all on you to, you know, get lower and avoid this guy's head as you're hitting him? Is it on the league to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen some way with more punitive measures for helmet-to-helmet hits? My perspective is kind of this, and it's not as simple as like, you can't get down to just looking at an individual hit in an individual game and try and legislate it. You got to be more macro than that, I think. So in pro sports, to me, if you want to grow, you want to make waves, if you want to get noticed, you need stars. You just need superstars. They make pro sports now. It's not about the league or anything else. It's about the stars, the players themselves, the guys on the field, seeing them with personality, creating highlights, building brand, becoming recognizable for people. You can't do that if your stars are getting concussions all the time, or they can't stay on the field because they're getting lit up all the time. And if you think this is me advocating for stars to be treated differently, I think I pretty much am. Every other sport does it. Why don't we? Did it for Brady. They do it for LeBron. They've been doing basketball and other sports for 40 years. There's another part of this, I think, that I honestly didn't think about this until I think it was Deemer Class who mentioned it on Twitter. But right now, parents are probably less likely than they ever have been to let their kids play football. Why? Because of concussions, because of brain injuries. Those parents won't trade one sport where concussions are a major risk for another. If they see plays like what happened to Sowers or what happened to Trainer, even though he didn't end up with a concussion, but like a violent hit to the head, or you hear that Sowers now has had whatever it is, 5 concussions in his career, they won't let their kid play lacrosse either. So look, you're never going to eliminate high hits. You're never going to eliminate concussions from a sport like lacrosse. It's going to happen. But I think it is time to start looking at treating them like football treats them, with ejections as a real legitimate punishment for it happening, as a way to try and reduce them happening in games. So in that instance, I feel like some of it is probably going to land at the feet of the league to figure out how to allow physical play and contact, but to just try and get some of these plays that knock the stars out of the game, you got to try and get rid of those. You know, I think the debate from those and then carried forward to, I believe there was a big hit in the BU game today, where a player was picking up a ground ball and got leveled, and it's the guy who leveled him. It was Brown and BU, and a Brown player leveled a BU player who was, you know, going for a ball and maybe didn't see the guy coming, and You know, is there contact to the head? There probably is. It looks like he lines him up and hits him in the chest, but definitely catches his head too. Their heads come together when he does it. So, you know, what do you do with plays like that? You can't do nothing. I don't think we're in a world where you can do nothing anymore. Again, because I hate the, and it's always out there. When I played, you could hit guys like that and it was fine. We're not playing when you played anymore. And that's a stupid argument. Because you know what we've learned since you played? That if you don't take care of your brain while you play these games, the sport will kill you while you play it. That's what football does. So you can't just do nothing. You can't just chalk it up to back in my day, we used to hit guys. Like, okay, I don't care. We're not back in your day. We're in a day where we can be smarter about the way we treat our athletes and the way we take care of them while they play the game. And I think you need to be doing that all the time now, especially in sports like this where concussions happen a lot. So, you know, I don't want to get into doing it at the college level in that Bryant Brown game. I probably spent more time on it than I wanted to already, just in that 10 seconds I just talked. But at the pro level, where you're trying to really get the game to grow, you need to keep the stars on the field. And if every time Michael Sowers is on the field, he's getting hit in the dome and going out for a head injury, it's just not going to work out. So, you know, that's kind of where I came out on the whole hits thing. I know, an upshot of all of this, if you want to try and take something, if you want to call it positive out of it, I don't know, is that there's a rivalry stirring there now. A real one. A very legit one. Water Dogs Cannons, the last three games against each other, have been electric. Not just with scoreline, because the scoreline hasn't even been close. In two of the three of them, the Water Dogs blew out the Cannons. But the team that has been more physically dominant or handed out more physical punishment or played that way, you know, jawed a little more, finished a check a little more, all that kind of stuff, that was the team that won. That dates back to the semifinals of last summer. And that's the kind of thing that stays with these guys. So now comes the hard part, though, for a rivalry. You have to just let it slow burn from here. You've got, if Jordy, if you're listening, you got a brisket on the smoker here, nice barbecue smoker going, brisket's on there. You do not just crank the heat up and try and cook the thing in an hour. You don't overdo it. Best rivalries build with passion over time, and it's not overnight. I'm sure between now and whenever they play next, there will be a zillion stories and content about the rivalry that they're going to have and the clips of the fights and the punches and the hits and all the other stuff and the talking. It's all going to just be around the clock as the game shows up. But there needs to be some restraint, some balance, because it's not on us to make the rivalry happen. It's got to be player driven. It's got to be on the field. That's when it'll be good. I know we live in a world where content and clicks and attention are king. I'm recording a podcast right now and I write content about lacrosse, and it's important to me that somebody eventually reads or listens to the things I put out. I get all that. But players on the field have to drive the rivalry, and then the content comes from what they do after they do it, not before. Let them show you how they feel about it, because they will. They'll let you know. After the press game, or after the finals in the post-game press conference, Kieran McArdle opened with, as a very, you know, obviously he's sad because he lost, but Coach Copeland was not happy about the way that game went. And all Kieran McArdle opened with when they asked for comments and thoughts about the game is all he said is, I shouldn't comment on the game because my daughter's here. That's all you need to hear right now from those guys. You know how they feel about it. And they don't forget these things. It stays with them. Marcus Holman talked post-game about, hey, you know, you asked him about the physical play, and he starts his answer with, in the semifinals, we got bullied. And then we got bullied again here. And they didn't want it to happen again. They remember these things, the way these games feel, the way their bodies get battered and broken in the course of them. Let them use that and drive the rivalry. We don't have to do that for them. Us media folks, us fans, we don't have to do any of that for them. They got it. I'm excited for the next few months of it. PLL hasn't announced matchups in the schedule until, you know, whenever they decide to actually put stuff out, yada, yada, yada. They'd be crazy, though, in my eyes, to not open the season with Cannon's Water Dogs. I know we're going to open in New York and it's Atlas's hometown and all that. Cannon's Water Dogs, I think, needs to be the first game of the year. Have them scrimmage at camp first. Have them scrimmage each other in training camp and start it there. That's how you kind of keep the fire stoked. You don't need a ton of content and memes and emojis and all the other stuff. Just keep the players around each other. Slow burn. Let them do it. And it's going to be so good. You can see it happening already. You just got to let it. I'm just going to leave it alone. I'm not even going to talk about it again until they play. How about that? Speaking of players driving things, we'll go back to kind of saying the loud part here, and that, you know, in pro sports, it's about superstars now, and PLL needs to find some. I think we need more in the PLL. I want to be clear that there are great lacrosse players on the field, the best in the world. There is no disputing it. Obviously, when I say the league needs stars, I'm not impugning the ability of the players themselves. It's better than it has ever been. That said, when I say you need stars, you need personalities. You need people that fans can see and know who they are when their helmet's off. And there's people that can try and help that along. I'll include that myself in that as somebody who maybe doesn't do enough to try and help that along as a media person. I think part of, you know, what I want to do myself going into the next season, and then, you know, as I continue to try and do this, is try and maybe get better with the questions I ask, be more provocative, give these guys more of an opportunity to share who they are, because that helps. But players need to also put themselves out there. And I know, look, these guys are all drilled. Say the right thing, do the right thing, team first thing, never take credit, all that stuff. But because they're all drilled that way, all their answers sound the same a lot. And when everybody starts sounding the same all the time with all that same kind of stuff, then nobody is really a star. Nobody stands out. That's just the same pro sports stuff all the time, around the clock. It's not going to take us anywhere. The stars in leagues offer sound bites that go beyond that stuff. And what I think the PLL needs more of is Nekhai Montgomery at this tournament. At the end of the Redwoods week, where the Redwoods had obviously, you know, they lost in the semifinal and, you know, were not happy about it. They were clearly upset by losing. They had crazy injury problems and were, you know, looked like kind of a frustrated group. And in the post game, it was, you know, Coach Collins and Nekhai was in there, and Nekhai clearly was talking from his heart and took it personally. Shared how much he loves Kobe Bryant. He has a Kobe Bryant tattoo. And he sounded, as he answered questions, in that like somebody with Kobe type drive. He talked about, I want to be more confident. I feel more confident after this tournament. His words, there's not a shorty in the world that can guard me. And that confidence from him can be a force on the offense, and that's what he wants to be. He's just talking about wanting to do more. The post-game press conference from the Redwoods is still up on social. You should go find it if you have not seen it and listen to Nekhai talk. To say nothing of this being a great soundbite, it obviously was candid, honest, and this kind of deeply personal bit of introspection, but that's when you do that and you put that on tape for everybody to see, people are going to remember that you said that, and they're going to see you at these games and say, that's Nekhai. He wanted to have a Kobe-like offseason. He wanted to then spend the next 3 months getting ready to run by everybody. So that tells a story. That's going to get a guy on TV on SportsCenter without a helmet on saying, meet this guy. You're going to remember him. That's what you need more of. That's what stars are like. So, you know, I look at the upcoming draft class. You got Pat Kavanaugh in it, who's, you know, he's been on Pat McAfee and he can be candid and all that stuff, but getting just a guy or two in each draft class won't do it. So I think you need more pros who are just magnetic and stand out to become recognizable, again, without a helmet on, outside of the highlights, because of what they say, because of their personality. So I hope we kind of, the Sixes event is an opportunity to kind of get guys to do that, because, you know, they're so compact. They're so close together with their teammates and with the games they play, and they get fatigued and they are forced into a position of deliver all the time around the clock for 5 days straight. And if you can't, you're probably going to lose and you're going to have to learn a thing or two about yourself. And those are the moments where you get like what you got from Nakai, and it was outstanding. It was outstanding to hear. So, you know, I think that was something else I kind of took away from this is, can this be used as a way to amplify the stars a little more? I did, you know, it was funny. I got a question during this event on social from someone named Sam, who I thought this was kind of an interesting question. He asked me, look, if I'm building the Olympic roster today, the Olympic Sixes roster, how many guys on that roster are in the championship series versus how many guys are currently playing in the NLL? And that's tricky because there were guys at the championship series who were also NLL guys. Colin Kirst has had a great event. He's on Vegas' practice squad the last time I looked. So I don't know if you count that, but he's a guy who would be on a short list for me as a Team USA goalie in 4 years. And again, I'm thinking about this as guys who could reasonably play 4 years from now in 2028, you know, and as a result, I think that makes it a lot harder to say too. Cause I mean, you could probably bet that like Joey Spallina is going to be in the mix there for Team USA. He's been very open about wanting to play both indoor and outdoor pro lacrosse. That's what he wants to do. I would bet there's quite a few curses in the mix for this event. You know, Cole and Connor were in the NLL, couldn't play in this for the Redwoods and Cannons respectively. Schreiber will probably still be out there. He'll be 35 when we play the Olympics, and he's an NLL guy. But, you know, he's Captain America, man. He's got to be on that first Olympic team. You know, Blaze Reardon makes a ton of sense as a goaltender too, obviously. NLL guy. Bertrand makes sense for this. He's an NLL guy. But then, you know, you look at like Brendan O'Neill, Schellenberger. You know, I don't know if Kavanaugh will be in the mix or not. You know, you kind of see how that goes. But as of right now, Team USA probably has more guys at the Champ Series or in college, I will say, than they do in the NLL. If I had to try and think about the roster that I would put together. But it's an interesting question. The event was, again, this could not have been more fun in person. Sixes in person is still the way to do it. It's just different. I can't explain what it is. You just have to be there to see it to really feel the intensity of that format. Obviously, there were some more one-sided games this year, I felt like, but then when you're watching, they never really feel that way. You know, you look up at the scoreboard and you see one team leading by 5 or 6, you're just like, really? It feels like everybody just put the ball in the net a lot. You know, goals happen so frequently. They happen so fast. It's difficult to spend time in any one moment where you're just like, this one's getting ugly. Because the team you're about to say this is getting ugly about is going to just score in 2 seconds from now. So the venue was great. I really like the St. James for this. I thought the broadcast was really good. I caught kind of what I could in replays, obviously after the fact. I wasn't listening while the games were going on, but the crowds were packed in for the weekend. As I said, Saturday bar down was like 3-4 people deep and loaded up, and it looked like it was a great time in there. This really is, I think, a very strong event for the PLL. They already announced they're going to be back again at St. James for 2025 to do this. I will be there as long as they're going to have this. I'm going to keep showing up for it. I've come to really, really love it. Let's get on the college game a little bit here. Enough PLL talk for the moment. Actually, before, you know, I didn't originally plan on having anything in here on this because the news is kind of happening as I'm getting ready to record, or it's been out for now, probably for a few hours. It's been out as I sit here and record on Tuesday night. But the Riptide are, in fact, going to be moving to Ottawa. The announcement's going to come tomorrow. I think around 11 o'clock in the morning, it's going to be officially announced and everything. Apparently the mascot, I guess there was a page or something up for a while where the mascot is going to be like the Black Bears or something like that. But the Riptide are going to be no more at the end of this season. Very sad for me. Personally, I'm just going to obviously just take this 100% personally, like it was done to make me feel bad. But, you know, the Riptide have had a hard time drawing a crowd since they've been there. As Graham Perro pointed out, I believe in his NLL chatter this week, but the game they just played in Montreal had a bigger attendance number than any home game the Riptide have played in their franchise history. And they had like 6,000 people, something like that. So the Riptide haven't been able to draw tons of crowds. You know, I don't want to get into the reasons why that might or might not be. But, you know, I'm sad because they were kind of my closest team to home. So as I tried to get myself, you know, more into the box world, and I've come to really love box lacrosse and indoor lacrosse now, it was my place that I would go to see a game on the weekend kind of on a whim, or if I, you know, had a had some free time for it, then that's where I would go, is go see the Riptide if they were at home. And I don't really have a whole lot of options close to home anymore. It's like Albany or Philadelphia for me. Neither one of those is all that close, or necessarily maybe a place I'm crazy about going all the time. But very sad for that to happen. Hopefully Ottawa treats this team well. They're getting a roster that has a bona fide MVP candidate on it basically every year in Jeff Teat. So, you know, very sad for the people of New York and Long Islanders who were loving the Riptide. As somebody who went a lot, there was definitely like a regular crowd of people you saw at every game who were loving it there and who really liked this team. And so sad for them. But, you know, I hope in the end it's for the greater good and lacrosse grows. And again, the fans in Ottawa welcome their team that's getting moved there next year. And they show up with giant crowds and they do the team proud. And I hope the Riptide players are happy with the move and are excited to be, you know, growing in a new market. So that'll be our ribbon on the pro news of the world today. Kind of a sad pro note to end on, but yep, Riptide, I will be at some of your games for the rest of the year. My ask of you at this point is to play well enough to get a home playoff game that I can attend. And otherwise, I'll see you for a couple more home games we got down the stretch before we call it quits. Farewell, Riptide. All right, on to the college game. A stroll through my top 20 for the week. Apologies for this to be a day late again. Like I said, I had a rough travel home. And then, honestly, like I drafted this, my top 20, on Sunday night when we vote, and then realized I didn't send it. And I think I sent it in last minute on like Monday morning. And I don't even know if it got to the IL guys in time to get out. I really hope it did, because I try and take this seriously. But anyway, my top 20 for this week. Number one, I have Notre Dame. Two games, two beatdowns for Notre Dame. They beat Cleveland State and Marquette a combined, I believe, 44-11. They get a decent test this week against Georgetown. But even there, I'd expect heavy favorites to be wearing the Golden Domes. The Cavs have 12 points each. The midfield is a matchup nightmare. I already have my eyes on Notre Dame's March 3rd date with Maryland. That's going to be a doozy. At number two, I have Duke. Last week, I had Duke 3 and UVA 2. Now I'm back to this. It's basically just me flipping based on recent performance. I thought Duke's thudding of St. Joe's once they got themselves moving was impressive this week. The talk around Duke now, though, has been more often now related to Ryan Boyle's take that Brennan needs to win a title to cement his legacy at Duke. That's the kind of take that's going to kick a hornet's nest on Lack's Twitter. And of course, that's exactly what happened. There were agreements. There were disagreements. You can count me on the agrees with Ryan Boyle side of this. There's just a different measuring stick if you're at a place like Duke. There are people who throw out names of other great players who never won a title and are still regarded as all-time great players. You know, it was actually something of a conversation at the championship series between games. You know, we were in the kind of like the media tent there talking about it, and names getting thrown out were, you know, guys like Lyle, who never won a title at Albany. But Lyle's legacy is he made Albany. He had a 400-point season. He launched Albany, or a 400-point career, I should say. He launched Albany to new heights. They are what they are now because of players like Lyle going there. The title isn't really part of that equation. There's other schools where you need to win a title while you're there. At places like Duke, Syracuse, even Hopkins, if you're that caliber player, a Brennan O'Neill caliber player, you need a ring. And if you don't have one, you're just not remembered the same way as the ones who do, as the other guys who do. It's just I'm not passing judgment on whether that's right or wrong, or if that's how it should be or shouldn't be, but that's how it is. And, you know, a great champion of this, you know, was talking with Joe Keegan. You know, he was there in the tent talking about this, and he threw out the name, you know, Kevin Rice at Syracuse. And, you know, Joe is a huge Kevin Rice stan. And if you are familiar with Kevin Rice's career, you're probably a huge Kevin Rice stan too. He has some truly bonkers numbers at Q's. He's one of the top 10, I think, highest scoring players in Q's history. He had an 84-point season accuse. That's how many Mikey Powell had as a sophomore. He's only a couple behind a season that like Ryan Powell had as a junior. He's right there with some of the most productive seasons that Hughes has ever seen, that Hughes has ever had. But you know what Kevin Rice doesn't have? A ring. And since he doesn't have a ring, when those lists of all-time greats at where the orange come out, and Kevin Rice deserves to be in that conversation of one of the greats to play at Syracuse. He was that good. But he doesn't have a ring, so they don't talk about him like that. I don't think that's where Brendan O'Neill's destiny is if he doesn't have a ring. He's going to have, obviously, the world games. He's going to have a pro career in a world that, you know, the pro environment that Kevin Rice got to play in is obviously a different one than the one Brendan will play in. But if you don't have a ring, you're just not remembered the same way at a place like Duke. It's just how it is. I'm thinking May, this conversation goes to bed anyway, if you get my drift. But yeah, just I wanted to touch on that as we talked about Duke this week. At number three, I have UVA. The Cavs beat a frisky Richmond team who's giving giving teams some real fights. Per usual, a lot of contributors for the Hoos. I still have some very minor nitpicks with this team, basically all of them face-off related. Gobio makes you feel better every week, but this is the week where you're going to learn if they are really okay facing off or not, because they're going to play Ohio State this week, and Tommy Burke and Jack Oldman will let you know if you can face off well or you can't. As you can imagine, this top three in this order matches the top three that came in the Inside Lacrosse poll. My team at four also matches the Inside Lacrosse poll. I have Maryland at four after their overtime thriller with the Cues. Terps, two OT wins in three games. And this one in the Dome is a great win, obviously, because of what the hype that Syracuse has right now. The talk, of course, around this is around the end of the game. Cues hits a winner. It is disallowed after review. Michael Leo is ruled to have broken the goldmouth rule. And then moments later, Stamos hits a winner to ice it for the Terps. I'll just say this. If you're complaining about the end of the game, I'm not totally sure what the beef is. Is the goldmouth rule and everything that has come with it in recent years horrendous, and do I hate it? Yes, absolutely hate it. Hate it every time I hear the words goal mouth on broadcast. It makes my skin crawl. But it's also the rule. And as I looked at those replays and I watched all that stuff, it looked to me like it was applied to the letter of the rule correctly. The goal comes off. Sorry. Does the rule suck? I think the rule sucks. But it's the rule. And it's not a new rule. And it's applied the way that you would want a referee to apply it. Exactly as it's written. So, and then, ultimately, Hughes didn't lose the game there. They lost the game because a redshirt freshman in Stamos had time to step into a shot and transition and win it, and nobody stepped up and stopped him. Like, you could always just prevent that from happening, too. Having had the chance to rewatch a lot of this because I didn't see it live, the game itself, I know I had to spend all that time on it, and I'm going to tell you right now, it was stupid to do that. The game ruled. Game was awesome. Don't let the goldmouth thing be the only thing you talk about in this game. Great individual matchup in it with Zapatello and Spallina. They had a great battle all day. Logan McNaney looked very much like he was in his tournament most outstanding player type form. Luke Roa showed you that he can do everything on offense. Any which way you need goals scored, he can score them that way. I thought it was something of a coming out party for him as a legit star. So definitely liked the look of Cues in this one. But, Maryland, I have a four here because they won this game. And this is just the kind of game that a Tillman team wins. Number five, I have Cornell. IL poll has them a little bit lower than I do. They're at eight in the poll. Eight's where they were in the final poll a week ago as well, so I guess I just continue to overrate Cornell. But I liked what I saw from them in the debut. It's about what I expected, I think. Offense was humming. They put up 17 goals. I think you got a decent first start from Knust and Goal, who made, I think, 14 saves, over 50%. Jack Keskin, great facing off. And when that happens with Cornell's attack, it's just tough to overcome. Michael Long had 7 points. When he's healthy, he's just so good. He's really fun to watch with the ball on his stick. When you look at the players on that attack, Michael Long is a quarterback who can run an attack full of quarterbacks. Will Firth, 4 goals. Start watching him, folks, if you haven't seen him yet. If you haven't had a chance to watch him before now, he's a freshman there, but you're in for a treat. He is going to be a special player for sure. He's a special player. Cornell will take on Denver this week. So it's top 10 matchup there. Number 6, I have Army. They came in at 7 in the IL poll, so I have them one spot higher. Black Knights just dominated Rutgers. There's no two ways to say that. Rutgers started well, scored the first, I think, goal, maybe even 2 goals of the game, but Army was just overwhelming the rest of the day. They had 4 different players with at least 3 goals, and one of those guys wasn't even Reese Burick. Will Colletti, 17 of 25 facing off. This looked like the Army team that I kind of expected coming into the year. You know, this is what I expected them to do to UMass. Basically, faceoffs, keep the ball with them, and if you do get the ball, you're going to have to score with your best player being erased by AJ Pilot. So Army came in at 7 in the poll. I still think they're really good. If you want to do the old game of pick somebody from outside those, you know, the ACC, the Ivy, and the Big Ten to make the Final Four, Army is the pick for sure. Number 7, I have Denver. They came in at 5 in the IL poll, so ahead of Cornell and Army. To me, if you put Denver on the field today against Army or against Cornell, I'm probably picking against Denver. So I settled in with the Pios at 7. They have 3 wins, 2 of them against teams that I have ranked at some point this year. They held Utah to just 8. Stathicus had a lot to do with that. I think this Denver team has been very impressive in the early goings, even with some younger guys out there. Silstrop is obviously their lead dog, but they really do play good team offense. I think that's a testament to Coach Metzbauer joining their staff. So they play Cornell this weekend. We'll see if I'm right or wrong about that Cornell-Denver take from about 2 seconds ago. At number 8, I have the Q's. Syracuse came in at 6 in the poll. I have them at 8, basically right around, maybe a bit lower than where they were a week ago. Again, they had the game against Maryland won. Like, they literally hit the game winner, and it got waved off. So as soon as that happened, they give up the game winner. Luke Roa, I'll say it again, the full bag of tricks on display in this one. Whatever you want your offensive star to be able to do, he did it in this game. Absolutely in the zone. And I think if you're a Hughes fan, you feel good about that because it shows you how many other guys you have, just yet another guy who can shoulder the load if Spallina is limited. And I think he still had 3 points with Ajax on him. And I think that's about as much as you can expect to see Spallina limited over the course of the year. So, you know, there's plenty to still feel good about here. But the Orange have a midweek matchup with Utah. And then we should get what will be a great one against Army midweek next week. Those midweek Hughes Army games are always so good. And I hope for posterity that Ryan Powell is somehow on the call. That would be great. He's been on the call for these in the past, and it's always a ton of fun. At 9, we have Hop. That matches where they came in the final poll spot. Hopkins beat Loyola this week. They've won 3 straight. 7 points for Angeles, who's now sitting on 21 points, which is near the top of the leaderboard nationwide. I think he's, you know, top 5, top 4. He's played 4 games, so more than a lot of teams, but to be that productive on a team with this many weapons and this many players who like need the ball and all that speaks to just how much he's a key for them, how much he's leveraged in their offense. I think most others have been about what's expected. Most other spots in the field, Smith is looking good to me on defense. He's, you know, been exceptional. Erlen has been what he kind of always has been, where he's got some great moments, then some medium moments, but you know, he's had enough good ones that, you know, you don't ever feel bad about starting him. They're kind of playing to expectation. Hopkins is to me right now. They've got the ACC stretch here coming because they play UNC this week and then they play UVA and Q's over the next 2 weeks. Their next 3 games are UNC, UVA, Q's. So we'll see if Hopkins is the best team in the ACC or not, I guess. Number 10, I have Yale. Yale beat Villanova this week, 13-11. Man, oh man, are the Elis hurting. Brad Sharp is obviously done. Leo Johnson's out. Chris Lyons was out for this game. But the offense still wasn't really a problem. It hasn't looked like one through the fall, through scrimmages and, you know, in early spring, David Anderson, Carson Cool hat tricks, each freshman, Peter Moynihan had some really nice moments. Max Kreske is a really good midfielder. Brandau, of course, is still out there. He had 6 points. The question is always going to be with the defense Are they going to need to lean on, like, you know, Jared Paquette to be supernaturally good and bail them out? Villanova does not have a really stacked offensive group. They still put up 11. This is it. The 13 and the, and this kind of production, I guess, is good enough for Yale to win a lot of weeks, even injury depleted. But it is tough, especially when you don't have your horses and your stars to win shootouts every week. So defense, like, not a bad start. Bigger tests are coming. Number 11, I have Penn State. They came in at 13 in the final poll, so I guess they overrate them a little bit. After losing to Colgate, the Quakers are 2-1. Their attack has been very, very good. I have been bullish on this team, so maybe I'm just biased, but I expect them to be fine. Their defense really limited Dylan Palinetti this week, which isn't easy to do. If they get more consistent, really high-level play from Frakion, they'll be on their way, I think. This week's test is a really good one. They take on Navy. I think there's a good strength against strength in this. Navy's close defense is very good. Penn State's attack is very good. There's going to be fun matchups there. At 12, I have Princeton. Princeton came into the final poll at 11. The Tigers opened the season with a win over Monmouth. Really nothing to write home about there. Obviously, they were a heavy favorite. The noteworthy thing there is you kind of get to see some of what a rebuild offense looks like. Colin Burns, 7 points, leads the team. Nate Kiberi, 5 points, tied with McAsee for second on the team in the game. So you got two freshmen there getting comfortable right away, and you have to feel good about that. Even if it's not an off-the-charts challenging opponent, you know, getting these guys into a Division I game atmosphere and having them produce like that, it should feel good. I think the defense looks solid. Gian Fricaro was awesome. Princeton just kind of notched this sort of methodical get-it-done win. They're playing Manhattan, I think, right now as I'm recording this. I would imagine they win that game, and then they play Maryland this weekend. So that's Princeton's first real big test. At 13, I have Michigan. The poll has them at 12. So I sort of have this group of three of Penn State, Michigan, and Princeton just kind of jumbled up together from where they are in the final poll. But it sounds like most voters kind of have these three teams in this 11, 12, 13 spot. Michigan beat up Canisius last week. They beat up Hobart this week. Neither of that is all that impressive to me. This week, they play Marquette, where I'm sure they'll be favored. I haven't looked at the line yet, or I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm sure Michigan will be favored in that game. We'll see how much Michigan can really do to kind of climb the polls before they take on Notre Dame in a few weeks. There's not a whole lot. They play Delaware, but, you know, Notre Dame is really the next huge, huge test for them. Bo Lockwood is leading this team with 11 assists. I don't think any of us saw that coming, so pleasant surprise there, too. At 14, I have Delaware. This is where they are in the final poll. They're also at 14. Blue Hen's going to hen. They are 2-0 against some light competition. Mike Robinson has 14 goals and 0 assists in 2 games. And if you're talking lefty shooter from Peterborough kind of stat lines, that's my favorite kind of one right there. 14 goals, no assists in 2 games. The first test for the Hens comes this week. They play Penn, who has a good goalie, some good defensive pieces. So that'll be a fun one, I think. Penn is kind of getting their footing down and learning, you know, how guys are fitting in. Leo Hoffman, I think, has been really good for them through 2 games. For a freshman, seeing as much kind of usage as he is, that's a good sign. He was already getting a pull in a game that was played earlier today against Albany. So good test there for Delaware against a solid Penn team. 15, I have UNC. This matched the final poll spot that also has UNC at 15. They rolled Fairfield this week. They played that game at Georgetown Prep, so neutral site, I guess. If you're a UNC fan, I imagine you were loving this game. 7 points each from Dominic Petromala and Owen Duffy. You're just like, hell yeah, there's the future. They combined for 8 goals and 6 assists. McGovern in there with 5 points. He's as consistent and solid as they come. This game was never really all that close. UNC has a really nice face-off battery developing too, which is tough to scout, tough to deal with. Brady Wambach and Andrew Terrar, you know, they'll go with the guy who can beat your guy. And if you get that guy figured out, they're going to mix it up and go to the other guy and give you somebody to figure out again. You know, Michigan executed this very well last year with Nick Rowlett and Justin Wheatfelt, and UNC looks like they're kind of developing that this year. They play Hopkins this week. That'll be one of the more intriguing matchups of the weekend. not just because both teams are good, but because Coach Petromala is going to coach against Hopkins. We love that. 16, I have Rutgers. Rutgers obviously has to drop after getting shellacked by Army. I just kind of trying to figure out how far. Ross got, you know, got limited pretty heavily by AJ Pilot. Rutgers is now sitting at 2-1 with wins over Lehigh and Stony Brook. Not bad, not great. Loyola is an interesting test for them this week because the Loyola offense has some nice pieces. The Rutgers offense will give Loyola, I'm sure, fits. I still like this Rutgers group. I think they could create some good offense. Army's defense just really cracked down on them hard, and Will Coletti denied them the ball. So they didn't really, you know, they didn't really ever have a chance to get things going. Ohio State, I have at 17. It felt like people were down on the Buckeyes coming in because they were so underwhelming last year, and rightfully so. Whatever, 5-8, 5-9 last year, 5-9. And while they aren't overwhelming people or anything right now, they're stacking wins. They're 4-0. Their best win's Utah. All right, not great, but like Utah's, you know, a team that's going to be in the getting ranked conversation, or was maybe until they're now 0-2. But Bobby Van Buren is back in the lineup. That's huge because they take on Virginia this week, and that's where we're really going to learn what this Ohio State team's all about. At 18, I have Georgetown. Hoyas with a very needed win against Penn, and so they're back in the poll for me. They came into the final poll at 19, so I have them one spot higher. Graham Bundy, 6 points. Back to form for him. You got to love that if you're a Hoya fan. They needed this one. They have Notre Dame up next, and their February schedule has been brutal. But I think you got what you wanted in this one. You got a pretty complete effort. Ball was really good facing off. Anderson Moore, I think, was right around 60% in goal. Aiden Carroll has been very good kind of in the early goings for me. And I think when Alex Verdaro kind of gets his feet under him and is showing up on the stat sheet a little bit more, I think that's when the team takes off. So I feel like they're putting the pieces together now, the Hoyas are. We'll see. Again, Notre Dame this week is as tough a test as you're going to get. We'll kind of really get a feeling for where this team is then. At 19, I have Richmond. I struggle with Richmond because they are 1-2. The final poll has them 17, and that feels too high to me. I don't know. The two losses are Maryland in double overtime and UVA. Okay, two top four teams that you played, all things considered, pretty close. Obviously, a Maryland double OT game is very close. They played UVA to a four-goal game. But at the end of the day, those are still losses, and I don't, this is just me, I don't love to improve a ranking or move a team up in the poll for losing close to a heavyweight contender. I know there's other factors there if other teams are moving around them and everything, but the lopsided win over Bobby Morris doesn't really do a lot for me. And the schedule for a while now is pretty, you know, it ain't Maryland and Virginia. So there's a chance they're going to keep winning, but still maybe kind of drop down if other teams that aren't in the poll get wins over better teams than who Richmond is playing now. But look, I don't want to make it sound like Richmond's a bad team because they're not. Coach Giamatti is a great coach. Richmond is seriously talented with players like Dalton Young and Lance Badonna. They're a really good team. But again, just me personally, if you lose, it's hard for me to be like, yeah, but you played them close. So make sure you're ranked for playing them close. Like, I don't like to do that with losses, just me. Their next really big one is Duke on March 16th. So they got a little time to kind of tune things up against some teams that they should probably beat before they play the Blue Devils. At 20, I have Colgate. I still have Gate in. Colgate did come in the final poll at 20. They just beat Albany. That's a solid win. It was a one-goal game. That's a solid win, though. They'll trade on that Penn State win for a while, probably. They're going to be up against Yale today, as you're listening to this on Wednesday. Colgate plays Yale today. And maybe that's a better game than you might have thought a couple weeks ago. Yale, as we said, injury depleted. Colgate is not backing down from anybody. They are very talented. I think Drewin's a good player. It's the kind of game where, you know, the Yale defense, you're going to find out how legit it is. I think Pisano was really good in their opener against Villanova. You know, so you see kind of the individual talent on display. But the thing with them has always been the team defense. So we'll see how that looks. This, again, matches the final poll. Other teams I kind of considered, BU lost to Bryant by 6 goals, and I dropped them out for that. They really are probably still my 21 or 22, I would say. They're playing Brown, and I think they won. They beat Brown, yes. If with that win and maybe some other teams losing, maybe they go back in. Brown hasn't looked great. You know, Brown's always going to scrap with you, but at the end of the day, they lost to Quinnipiac in the opener, so I don't know how much a win against Brown is doing for you right now, but still a win over an Ivy for BU. Bryant could easily be in this poll off the BU win. If you voted for them, I totally understand why you would. If you're telling me I'm an idiot for not voting for them, I get it, because they beat BU, but there's just too many other wins or other teams notching bigger wins ahead of them right now, I guess. I still love the offense that Bryant plays. They are fun to watch. Like BU, they are playing today, or Tuesday night, as I should say, as I record this. The BU game is over. I don't know what's going on in the Bryant-Harvard game. Let's take a look real quick. Harvard won. All right. Harvard won 14-13. So, Bryant, you might not be being considered for the poll anymore. But Harvard, you are, and I considered you before that game. They blew the doors off Providence. Sam King was electric. I mean, look, Harvard got a goalie goal against Providence. Christian Barnard went coast to coast. How can you not consider a team for top 20 after that? They got to empty the bench a bit, yes, but Harvard top end looked really good to me, even against banged up Providence. And now they have the win over Bryant, which I think is a good one. So Harvard very much considered. They might be in the poll next week. I'll get a really good look at them because they are playing in my backyard. They're playing Bucknell this weekend, and they're playing at Wilton High School here in Connecticut. So I will be over there to see that one in person, I think. Finally, I did consider Penn still. I dropped them out after the loss to Georgetown. I already kind of had them right on the edge. They really struggled facing off in that game. You saw 2 goals from Hoffman in that game. And again, Penn looked better today against Albany. Gabe Fury, though, was 0-for-8 in that game against Georgetown. And you need more from him than that. He's going to be one of the key pieces in the midfield for them. So you're still trying to figure out maybe whose team this is for Penn. I think they're a team that's probably in between 21 and 24. So right on the edge of going back in. As we said earlier, their next game is Delaware. So, you know, it's a ranked opponent this weekend for them to get a win and move back in. Other teams that were getting votes that I maybe didn't think about, Loyola got thumped by Hopkins this week. I was kind of lukewarm on them coming in anyway. I like their offense. The defense had major questions. I think the Georgetown win is obviously a good one, but maybe not as good now that the Hoyas are 1-2. I have not loved how the Hounds have looked the last couple of weeks. High Point got votes. They're 3-1 right now. Their wins are Mercer, VMI, and Queens. For me, you got to do better than that if I'm going to rank you. They play Cleveland State this week. That's not going to do a lot for you. I'm sure they're going to win that game. They're at Q's on March 2nd. You win that, you'll be ranked. But I did not consider voting for High Point yet, just off of wins over those three teams. UMass got votes. I did not really consider UMass. They let Lowell hang around, and that was a little bit surprising to me. After the showing against Army, I thought they would roll in that game, and they did not. It was not a comfortable win for UMass at all against a team that's not good. They were better today. They beat a Marist team that I like. They beat Marist 18-11 today. So obviously a better showing there from UMass. You know, we'll kind of see maybe how things look for them. They have Merrimack this weekend. It's not going to do a lot to move the needle. Their next big chance to really make an impression is Rutgers on March 16th. Until then, you would expect them to beat Merrimack. You would probably expect them to beat Albany, Vermont. You'd think if UMass is hanging tough with Army, then you should be winning those games. Finally, I want to shout out NJIT, man. The Highlanders are 3-0. Wins over St. John's, Siena, and Mount St. Mary's. Not Murderers Row, but people were high on Siena before the season, and they're favored against Monmouth. They're playing Monmouth today, if you're listening, on Wednesday, February 21st. Find some time for that on the screen. ESPN Plus, get the A crew out to NJIT and Monmouth today. Get Anish, get Kark, get Quint, get them all out there. it's one of the more fun starts to the season is NJIT getting a 3-0. I hope they can keep it rolling. So I will be watching a little bit of that if I can, sneak away a little and try and catch some NJIT in Monmouth. But I don't know what it's going to take for NJIT to get ranked. They're probably going to have to win a few more here in a row. If they go to 4-0, then I guess maybe you think about it. They play Manhattan after that. They play Wagner after that. Lindenwood after that. I mean, you tell me why this team can't be 7-0 going into the Vermont game. I don't know. But yeah, NJIT deserves some flowers. They are out to a 3-0 start. They're getting favored in games, and they're winning. It's been fun for them. So that is going to be it for today. We'll be back with the regular sort of cadence of things again. I'm going to try and get to NLL power rankings for midweek at some point this week. We'll get, obviously, the NLL primer on the weekend and the weekend preview podcast episode Friday. I will bring back my three favorite games this week, travel and mayhem with the PLL Championship Series, and then just things with my real job that I have to do during the day. Kind of threw off my regular schedule for last week, but we will be back into it this week. So look out for all that content coming Friday. And I have a whole bunch more PLL stuff kind of in the hopper. And you'll see more work for me too for my other outlets, not mine, other outlets that are nice enough to let me write for them. New England Lacrosse Journal, Prep Network. You'll see some stuff there too. So thank you again for coming back and sticking around with me.
Is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.